Session number 7257.
Mr. Lane, tape 7. You mentioned leave, Mr. Lane, and that you did go back to Blighty.
Yes.
How often did this happen? Because after all, you were there most of the war,
well,
weren't
yes,
you?
Well, yes, I can tell you. My first leave occurred in December 1915. That was about over 13 months after we'd... And my next leave was in May 1916, only a short period. And that's the only two leaves that I had, because after that I got wounded, you see, and that sort of thing. But that was the only two leaves I had, and they were 7 days each.
Was that general to have so little leave?
It was in the early days, yes. Oh, yes. You did it, but they more or less drew lots for it, I think. Anyway, nobody got any leave. I was quite as soon as some of them. Some went quite a bit after I did. Officers got, well, I think they got a leave about every 3 or 4 months at that time. Certainly every 6 months. But we got about 7 days.
What did it mean to you to get home?
Well, it was... Oh, it was extraordinary, really. You came back, you see, you'd been used to this hard, dangerous life. And when you got to wherever it was, Folkestone, I suppose, or Dover, and got on one of our English trains, it seemed so marvellous, because we only usually travelled in cattle trucks, you see. And when you got into this train and found yourself smoothly running along, you just couldn't believe it. You couldn't sort of realise it. When I came home on my first leave, the night before there'd been an attack. Well, it was only a half-hearted affair, but we had to go out and repair the... I think we have to go out and repair the way. Anyway, I got caught up. I got my one leg of my trousers all caught up, so that I had a tear from there to about there in my trousers. Well, in those days, that first leave, we didn't have any delousing before we went home, you know. We had to go home just as we were. And I can also remember getting onto the tube, and it seemed you felt bewildered. There was two or three of us, and you sort of... You didn't quite realise where you were. And people looked at us askance. You know, we've got heavy beards because we hadn't been shaved for about a week. And I got this, my underpants showing through here. And we got home, and of course I said to them, look, I said, I must have a bath for a start. And then I said, look, I've got a tear in my trousers. And anyway, what I did was we had a good clean up. And I went down to Harford, and I got a new pair of trousers. I had a hell of a job to get a new pair. They didn't want to give them to me. Anyway, I insisted on it and got it. And then you slept in a bed, of course, which is like being in heaven in a way, after sleeping on the mud floor all the time. And you got good food, of course. But it all went so quickly, you know. It was all gone so quickly. But it was really, at the early stages, it was really like you were more or less bewildered. The life was so different, you see.
Did you notice any differences in England coming back a
year
later?
Well, the people in England had got no idea. They were being fed propaganda of the most blatant and lying kind that you could ever imagine. I think I said before, they used to think that going in with the bayonet, that was the way to win the war. It never occurred to them, if it was so easy, why in the hell were we stuck all those miles and couldn't get forward, you see? It was a sort of a strain. That, well, they didn't have any idea what was happening, you see, that was the point. So that you didn't get any satisfaction as regards the war, because... Nobody seemed to know, they seemed to have got no idea what it was all about. Anyway, that was the only two leaves I had. Oh, God. Oh, all there is to say about leave, Ali.
Did you mind going back after a leave, you know, or did you dread it?
Well, you felt, not dread, nothing as strong as that, but rather depressed, you know, naturally. No, I don't think there was anything. It was a kind of a fatalistic business, really. And in some ways, it's surprising, really. You see, you miss the company of the people in the line. I'll give you an instance of that. During the, it must have been 1916, I had an attack of, must have been pneumonia, I think. I remember getting up. We weren't in the actual front line. We were just behind on one of the slopes, you know, the downlands. We're living in bivouacs. This was in the winter, October, I suppose. Or September, October, I should think. And when I got up, I felt this terrific pain in my, just about here, you see. And I remember telling my comrade that, special comrade, that we had to go and get water in the well. There were wells built and made by the engineers. And I said, come on, I'll have to put my arm on your shoulder. I've got a pain in my side. Anyway, we got the water and I come back. And he said, you better go sick. I said, yes, I think I'd better. I went to the doctor's and he was some distance away. And he said, he gave me what they call, well, he put me off duty anyway, you see. And I came back. This was a very nice, well, it was a normal autumn day, overcast, raining, and just beginning to get cold. And he sent me back. Well, I simply lay in this bivouac, and in the evening, the medical orderly came around to me. He said, "Why haven't you been to the doctor's again tonight?" And I said, I didn't hear him say come again. Anyway, he took my temperature, and the next thing I was taken out to an ambulance. And I was still able to walk. I went to a huge marquee casualty clearing station, some distance behind the line, about a couple of miles, I suppose. And I slept that night, and the orderly came round. Well, I thought I slept. I must have been unconscious by the time. The orderly came round and said, "You've had a rough time, old chap, haven't you?" Well, I don't know. I couldn't remember much about it. And I must have gone off again, because the next thing I remember, I was in hospital at Trouville. And that's a long, long way away, you know. I must have gone unconscious. Anyway, I got down there and stayed in bed a few days, and I stayed there a few weeks, I suppose. Anyway, after a few weeks, the doctor came round and he looked at me like an old man, but he was only about 50, I suppose. And he said, "Are you ready to face the storm again?" I said, "Oh, yes, I'm all right, doctor." He said, "Are you sure?" He said, "You've been out here a long while." "Oh, yes," I said, "I'm all right." He was asking me to say no, really. He was asking me to ask for a bit longer. But that was the attitude, really. And so, of course, I was sent up the line to face the coldest winter that we'd had for about 100 years. I mean, after pneumonia. Anyway, I never felt any more of that.
Could I ask you about the difference which you mentioned earlier between the early volunteers and the men who came later?
Yes, well, I don't know that there's all that difference, really. There wasn't any enthusiasm, of course. I mean, when we were going to France, or before we volunteered even, there was arguments going on about whether we should volunteer or not. But some of the people would say, yes, we're going out and we're going to be right up in the bloody front line too, and that sort of thing. That was the attitude. And these other people that came along afterwards were, some were pathetic. Of course they were. They looked to us quite old men, some of them, only some of them. And you've got to be very nippy, you know, round about there, because you've got to, you know, if there was a, if they were shelling a certain area and the shells were coming home at certain intervals, you've got to make sure to move from one place to another in between the shell fire, you see. But anyway, they were quite good, really, most of them. I didn't notice all that difference.
Were they adequately trained, would you think, when they came?
I think they were trained. They'd been in England quite a while. I'm not talking about the last 1918, because they're sending out boys then, weren't they? 18 years, 18 and a half. And I don't know what happened, but I should imagine that quite a lot of them were not properly trained. But the training, this is training business in a war like that. It doesn't seem to me that there's much in it. I mean, all you had to do was to be able to fire a rifle, chuck a bomb, and well, really, all you had to do was to be prepared to be slaughtered. That's all. In other words, to stand up to shell fire. It's no good if your front line is being shelled in your particular area. Some people would tend, if a shell fell over there about 20 yards away, they'd start moving that way. Well, the next shell would probably fall there. You didn't know that. I mean, they were going to blanket the whole area. The only thing to do was to stay where you were and hope for the best. That was all there was. I mean, I can't see that. Training was all right if you're in open warfare. It's necessary, essential. But in trench warfare, I mean, you've got to learn to move quietly and to move on right in the probe position and that sort of thing. But honestly, I don't think the training had much. I mean, you wouldn't sight a machine gun or a Lewis gun, you know, unless you've got a good field of fire, you've got to have that. And sniping, I was a sniper for about 6 months, I suppose. Now, that's another aspect that is interesting, really. It is to me. When we went to France, we had no snipers at all. I mean, I was a good shot, but I was never designated as a sniper. And the Germans, that was one of their specialities, really. They could pick men off. Well, of course, they got telescopic sights, you see. And they were picking. They must have killed and wounded thousands of people. And they were very astute. They used to get up trees and camouflage themselves if there was any position where they could look down on us. They do that, you see. It took us a long while to learn. Eventually, while I was in the sniper's squad, we were issued with telescopic sights. And it was a revelation. Now, in a sniper's squad, you'd have a man with a telescopic sight and a rifle, on his rifle, and you'd have an observer with a telescope. And the first morning we had this, we were somewhere up near Cambrin, I think, and we had this, looking through this telescope. This was in the morning, not long after, of course, you know, we used to stand too in the morning and evening. Well, this would be about after breakfast time, I suppose. And there were looking at the German front. Now, you've got to remember that we daren't put a finger up above the trench. There were German soldiers gazing over the parapet, head and shoulders, puffing away at cigarettes. There was one old chap who was evidently an engineer. He was building up a sort of a saphead, all in broad daylight, mind you. And we couldn't possibly do anything. Oh, my God, he said, look, my God, you've got some targets there. And he directed me onto a certain target, which was a couple of German soldiers doing something or other. And I couldn't miss them, I mean, it's impossible to miss them. And then more came running up, and we must have got three or four of them in the end. And we had to pay, well, we didn't pay for it, but they intended to. Not long after that, they gave us a little pasting with their shell fire. But nobody was hurt. We never had a casualty. Extraordinary, that was. Anyway, that was the end of their superiority in sniping, because we eventually got a lot more telescopic sights. But they'd have had these almost from the start, you see. I mean, I've been in a trench. You know, the front line, of course, wavered around sort of all over the place. And I've been looking at a periscope on the Parados, which reflected the no man's land. And I've had a bullet come just over my shoulder and land in that parapet. Well, it must have been done with a sniper's rifle. It couldn't, from quite a distance, it must have been done with a sniper's rifle. It wasn't, I mean, I wasn't hit. It was nothing to sing about or make a write home about. But it just shows you their superiority in those days.
Anyway, was there other equipment as good, you know, compared with
no,
yours?
No, they had, no, well, I'll mention that. Now, take it, when we got from Ypres and we got through the, well, it was about February 1915, we took over this Givinci position, which, as I said before, was a slight hill, really. Wouldn't be more than 150 feet. But it dominated the whole area, you see. And that was the first time, I think, that underground mines were... Well, you couldn't dig like an underground mine. You've got to have dry ground, you know, fairly dry ground. And that there was scope for that there. And each side was mining against the other. Well, now, as far as mining concerned, I should think we were on about equal terms. But one of the things about mining, or in that particular time, was this, that you would get down, you see, the idea of mining was that you had to try to get under the German line, or under their trench, which was never accomplished really, not exactly. But you went about 50 feet down, you know, and you boarded up, of course, this is where the mining engineers did all the actual, the infantry did all the hard slogging. For instance, all the earth that came out of that mine had to be put in sacks and dumped somewhere out of sight of the enemy, because they used to take photographs and they could see what you were up to, you see. And all the shafts would be boarded up. They were about that high, I suppose. Well, you had to bend down double almost. And they'd get down to where they thought was near enough under the German line. Then they'd have the gallery either side, you see. Well, in those days, the poor old infantry had to... They were called defensive galleries, really. The idea was not only to probably blow up the German mine, but to prevent them blowing you up, you see. And we used to have to go down there when the mine was finished with a candle and a rifle, and sit there for 2 hours and listen to see whether the Germans were mining anywhere round about. And in fact, they used to break into our mine sometimes. And when they did that, they'd pour gas into it, you see. And, well, that would naturally kill anybody. I think this was before the actual surface gas attacks were made. I mean, the Germans always had the gas and they used to use it. And I think that was one of the worst experiences, really, a claustrophobic effect of sitting down there for 2 hours. You could hear, if our people were shouting, you could hear the bomb going on over there. And you were listening, you see, tensed up to hear whether they were going to break through. And 2 hours of that was quite a strain, I can tell you. And then, of course, you went back up to the ordinary front line trench, and then you come to the other weapons. Well, up in the front line trench, the Germans had, they had, of course, hand grenades. We were very close, they were only 25 yards away sometimes. But the ground had been so broken up by mines that the whole of No Man's Land was a tortured mass of heaving craters and shell holes. Oh, God, it was horrible. And because if a mine went up, say a German mine went up, or our mine came up, the idea was if a German mine went up, we got to capture the lip of the crater on our side, you see, so that they couldn't come on our side. And what would happen, when a mine went up, you'd feel a rumble in the earth, tremor in the earth. And then you'd hear a underground roar. And at the same time, and you could hear the earth going on, at the same time you would open a terrific bombardment, artillery bombardment. So it was absolute pandemonium for about a few, well, for 10 minutes or so, and nobody knew what had happened, you see. And then you'd rush out to see, to capture the lip of the crater, if you could. So you can tell what No Man's like, what the land was like there. It was full of craters and old barbed wire. And anyway, not only that, that was the mining side of it. And I've known as many as five mines, might be two of ours and three of Germans, or the other way around, go up in about 10 days, you see. So you never knew. Now that's I can't tell you this song, but it started off with you're sitting on a mine, never mind. If you go up in the air, you say, I don't care. And you say a lot more obscene words, and that's it. But that was the feeling that in that front line, you never knew when you were going up in the air, apart from the other instruments of death and torture. For instance, they had what they called Minenwerfers. That means mine thrower. You knew that, I suppose, did you? Yeah. And now these Minenwerfers were dreadful things. They used to fire them with a sort of trench mortar, you see. And you could, in the daylight, you could see in the night too, you could see them in the daylight. And when they landed, if they landed anywhere near a trench, they'd blow the whole thing down, a terrific explosion. Well, they were about that high, you know, full of high explosive. And they use those persistently. In fact, that eventually, although people talk about the Somme and all that sort of thing, we know that was terrific, but the point of it was that on the Somme, people went in the line very often, went over the top, they got slaughtered or wounded or whatever happened, and they were taken out. But we were holding this wretched Givenchy position for over a year, 18 months, you see, and although our casualties weren't all that heavy, sort of not in a short time, there were a constant stream of them, you see. And it was a terrific place. Anyway, these Minenwerfers, at night time, we used to have a sentry in the daytime, and he used to have a whistle, you see, and one blast meant bomb right, two blasts meant bomb left, and if the thing was coming straight at him, I suppose he ran for cover, I don't know. But anyway, that was the situation. We got nothing. Do you know, I can remember what we had, I didn't see it ever used, was a catapult. A sort of a framework, like a V-frame, a rubber catapult. That was supposed to be in reply to the hopeless sort of thing. In fact, we used to have jokes. We used to put tins of bloody beef and try and float, catapult them over to the German lines. Oh, it was pathetic. Well, that was bad enough. And then, of course, they had, I told you, they had stick bombs. And there was the mines. Oh, rifle grenades, that was right. We had them eventually, but they had them first. That you fire a grenade about that size, you know. You stick it's got a stick on it, you see, on the end. You stick it down your rifle barrel. and fired an angle which you hope will direct it towards a German trench. And that was that. It was absolute hell out there in that place. You never got a moment's peace from the time you got there. That was a place where, as I've said before, the Welsh Fusiliers were overrun on the Kaiser's birthday. It was a terrific place. And there used to be a... We were all short of water there. And there used to be a... There's an old pump which, strangely enough, was still in use. It was on this hillside, on this sort of hill. And I think the church had been there too. Anyway, we had a, I think we must have been dug in under the, what was the church. We used to get our water from there. And you could only get it at night time because it was under observation in daytime. And this damn thing used to squeak, you know. Well, I don't know whether anybody hadn't got any oil or whether they couldn't stop it, but nobody ever did anything about it. And we used to rush out there and get our water bottles filled and rush away. If the Germans heard it, they could hear it, you know. They'd send a shell over. It was funny at times, really. It was all treated. Well, don't imagine that we weren't frightened. We were scared stiff up there at times. Absolutely terrified, petrified. But nobody made a... They never made a sort of a big deal of it. Oh, yes, it was a terrible place. It's in my memory more than the song.
Yes, I was going to ask you, if you wouldn't mind describing the various battles battle fronts you participated in. But I think perhaps we ought to have a new tape for that.
Do you?
Yes, we're running out.
What's the time? Oh.